Thanks for joining us here on Services School Stories. Your hosts for this season are Alec Emmert, Services School CEO and Navy veteran.
And Sydney Mathis, Chief Program Officer and former College Admissions Officer. This season, we'll cover topics as it relates to higher education, military service transition, and career opportunities and outcomes for veterans. Join us as we share student stories, inside tips from the admissions office, and conversations with employers actively hiring student veterans. Here we go.
All right. Welcome to the podcast. This is Alec Emmert, CEO of Services School. And today I have the distinct pleasure of interviewing Ryan Pavel, who is the CEO of the Warrior Scholar Project, an organization that's doing some incredible work in the veteran higher education space and really getting veterans prepared for college. And they've had some incredible results that he's going to get to share. So, Ryan, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Alec. I'm honored to be here.
Absolutely. So if you could just start us out with a little bit about your background before you joined the military and kind of the decision process that you went through to join.
Yeah, well, it was 2004. There were a few things happening then, back when I first started considering joining the military. I think this question is really interesting always because we have this, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot since 2004, which is now coming up on 20 years. And so every time you tell the story, right, like, is it the same as if I had recorded this answer 10 years ago or 15 years ago? So I think the reasons that I joined now are in some ways more clear to me and in some ways are some ways not quite as clear. I think that there's some aspect of being a 17-year-old and wanting to go out and to do something, something really meaningful and something where I felt like I could make an impact. There was certainly a lot that was happening in the country and in the world, but the reality for me too is that I probably would have gone to college had I gotten accepted to the college that I wanted to go to, and I didn't. And so no matter what patriotic reason or call to service or anything else like that, I got rejected from University of Illinois. And that was a forcing function for me to really evaluate what do I want to do with myself. And the Marine Corps recruiter was very persistent. He had a quota to meet, and I ended up calling him back. And it felt right. It felt like the sort of thing that I could go and I could make a difference. And I was a very apathetic high schooler, and so I wanted to be able to do something where I felt like I could actually get myself kicked into high gear. And I thought the Marine Corps could do that. It can. It did. So I think it's a mix of a bunch of different things. I don't know for anybody, certainly for myself, it's not a singular reason. It's not as simple as, well, this was always the path, or I have a family member that served, therefore I knew I was always going to serve. It's this whole mix of things that are swirling around in the head of 17-year-old Ryan.
Gotcha. And what attracted you? You mentioned the persistent Marine Corps recruiter, but what drew you to the Marine Corps over the other branches?
Look, I mean, if you're going to join, you might as well. Might as well join the best, you know. I mean, that's the way to go. I think Marines are, you know, one, we're all foolish to some extent, but I do think that there's some aspect to this pride that Marines have, and different units certainly have within the military. But every branch of service has their pride. But I think there's something about the bravado that was appealing to me at that age. I think there was something about the really putting themselves out there as if they are the lead, you know, the best, the tip of the spear, and whatever marketing you're sold at when you're 17, I think it works. And I think even now in my day-to-day life, I'm still very proud, not only that I served in the military, but that I was that I served in the Marine Corps, even though I didn't have, I think, the typical Marine Corps experience, you know. I mean, also around the time, that was the time of the commercials when the Marine was fighting the lava monster with his NCO sword. And you know, that's some of the most effective marketing out there. So that also played a role.
Yeah. We're the same age and I still remember that one. It's shocking that one didn't convince me to go Marines over Navy, but the ended up going the Navy route myself. But so you mentioned that your Marine Corps experience was not typical. So tell us about your MOS in the Marines and what you did while you're in the military.
Yeah. I mean, I was so eager to join that whatever they had, I was ready to sign up. And so they had a public affairs specialist. I said, sure, that sounds fine. Right. I wasn't interested in, an infantry. And so that's what they had an interest. I liked writing. Right. I thought maybe this would be something. And then they turns out that they also had a particular set of openings for folks to do the cryptologic linguist route. And so they have you take that secondary test, the D-Lab, where you come out and you have no idea what just happened, but maybe it was something which apparently they told me I passed, right? So apparently I did well enough that I passed. So I have an aptitude. Sure, if you tell me, right? My high school Spanish teacher would say otherwise, but I went the linguist route, and I was so eager that, and my recruiter was a little duplicitous in there, right? I signed and said, okay, I'll switch over to being a linguist. He said, oh, by the way, well, that adds a year into your contract, right? So now it was a 5-year contract instead of 4 years because the training would take over a year. And again, 17-year-old Ryan's like, ah, fine. It's like, all right, who cares, right? 5 years, 4 years, it's all kind of meaningless at this point, right? I want to go. I've made this path. I've made this decision. But I liked the idea of something rigorous. I liked the idea of building a really transferable skill, right? Not knowing if I wanted to do anything with Arabic, but I liked the idea of being able to learn something that I would be able to apply if I stayed in the military or if I didn't. And, you know, they train you, right? So 63 weeks, Arabic all day, every day at Defense Language Institute, at DLI. And you learn a version of Arabic that nobody actually speaks. But then from there, through dialogue courses or really by being in country, you're able to obtain the language skills. I was a halfway decent linguist. I'm very candid now with a lot of the folks that we serve at Warrior Scholar Project that I was a very average Marine, right? And tell people that I was the tip of nobody's spear. And that's, I think, an important thing to be able to acknowledge. Sometimes we paint ourselves into this corner as if, you know, you necessarily must have been part of some elite unit or done some elite missions in order for your military service to really be something which is valid or something to be proud of. And I certainly was not. I deployed a couple times to Iraq, but I was fortunate that these were non-combat deployments. I also try and be very upfront about that whatever missions that I did, most of the time when you're a translator, it's you and a pair of headphones, right? And you're translating whatever comes your way. But even when I was on missions, right, they were non-combat. And I think that there's also a stigma for Marines or for people who weren't in combat or for people who didn't deploy, or, you know, there's all these reasons that people might self-select out. And so I try and be really open around the fact that for me, that my experience was formative, but it isn't what people would, it's not the movie Jarhead, right? It's not anything like that. And I think that that's helpful both for veterans to be able to acknowledge that and also for civilian counterparts to be able to really understand and educate around what the typical military experience is like, right? I fall into the gap of what a lot of people do, which is one enlistment, right? Got out, went to school, doing something related to that area now, but that is a very typical experience, particularly for the Marine Corps, right? The Marine Corps is totally fine with people doing one enlistment. That's a big part of their model is that you need to have the 17, 18, 19 year olds that are willing to be able to just do their thing, right? And then get out after an enlistment. So I fall into that category and I wonder whether they got their money's worth, right? I mean, that's a lot of training for them to only get a couple deployments out of me. You know, they haven't asked for a refund yet for the training. So, but it was an interesting experience and it certainly pushed me. And please don't ask me to translate anything in Arabic now. But at the time, I was decent at what I did. But all this to say, I did not, you know, I had certain leadership opportunities while I was there, but there's no sort of like prototypical military leadership experience. And it drives me nuts when people describe, first of all veterans as heroes. That devalues what it means to be a hero. But it also actually drives me nuts when people describe all veterans as leaders. Because I think that there are some folks that really are able to rise to those levels, right? And be able to have those leadership experiences. But there are many, many people that don't. And that's fine. That doesn't devalue the experience. It's just, we need to be honest about sort of what we did and didn't do in the military.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. And it's something I personally have struggled with as well. Like I fall in the same boat, you know, never saw combat. I was a submariner. And then after that, I did several years where I was spending a lot of time in a skiff, like an SEI facility, just watching people do cool stuff on an ISR feed. So I'm very transparent about that. And especially I think veterans of our generation who kind of came of age in the post 9/11 era, where a lot of our peers were doing some pretty heroic stuff. For me, I always kind of felt like one of the other guys, you know, just in the background. And it's something that I've kind of come to terms with. And it sounds, I don't know what your process was, if it was, you know, initially you know, just going through the process yourself, you're fine. You went out to school, or if it was something you wrestled with. But for me, you know, definitely in the same camp as you, and what you said there really resonated with me as well. But yeah, switching gears a little bit to the college process. So you said you got out after your initial enlistment, and you had this Arabic skill. When you were looking for colleges, what was your process? Did you have like a set school you wanted to go to, a set thing you wanted to study, or how did you think through your next step after you left the military?
Yeah, I remember it very clearly. I was deployed, had access to Google for a little bit, and I Googled Arabic veteran in college, and then I applied to the schools that came up. So a very sophisticated search process, right? Exactly what both our organization, Services School and Warrior Scholar Project, would advise. I would change nothing. It was a starting point, right? And I think that this speaks to one of the challenges that we have with the overall transitioning veteran, but with any veteran that's interested in college. It so often starts with a Google search, and those search results are skewed at best, right? It's really hard to really be able to find some sort of resource. The VA has many attempts. There's plenty of third-party attempts to be able to provide clarity around how to search for those schools. But oftentimes it comes back to just a very basic Google search. And this is part of what I think has led to predatory for-profit schools being so incredibly successful in that space is, you know, they have the SEO figured out, and they have search results, and you can pay for promotional, you know, points on there and all of these things. For me, when I was doing that, I ran the search in 2009. And so back then, this was the first year that the post 9/11 GI Bill had been implemented. And so there were a couple schools that did rise to the top, the ones that already were able to have the machine built to be able to tap into that resource, right, into that revenue stream. And so I found one of the schools that came up, because it doesn't matter, as long as you're typing in, I think, veteran in college, right, you're going to get routed to probably American Military University. And I ended up coming close to going there. My joke is that before, like, my fingers like hovering over the button to submit my application, and then before I could even click it, they said, okay, you're in, you're up here, let's collect your GI Bill payments. All right, let's go, you know, let's go. But I also, I knew that I wanted to do something outside of just a for-profit institution. I couldn't have really articulated at the time the difference between nonprofit and for-profit institutions, but I knew I wanted to do something that was more akin to a traditional college experience. And so that kept me from going that typical route. And a lot of that is thanks to my upbringing. I'm not a first generation college student. My father's a physician. My grandfather's a physician. My mother has her master's, right? So college was always going to be this something where I had a good amount of college knowledge in my family, right? And so I had a sense and an aspiration to go and to do more of a traditional college experience. The challenge for me was that a lot of their experiences didn't really map on to anything that I could do successfully as a veteran, right? Like my challenges of transitioning and getting out, I'm a non-traditional student at that stage. And so their experiences aren't necessarily the right map on. So that gave me sort of the motivation and the idea to do it, to push beyond going to AMU, which I think would have been comparatively the easy route. But it's not as if it gave me the playbook for here's what that looks like to translate your veteran experience into successful college applications, or here's the schools that are thinking about transfer students and here's the schools that are not, that you have to basically start as a first year student. I think that actually speaks to one of the challenges that a lot of enlisted veterans in particular have, since two-thirds are first-gen college students. So they don't even have, they have the challenges that I had, right, getting out after 5 years and being a non-traditional student. But they also have not necessarily that familial pull or, you know, amount of insight to be able to pull from to motivate them to go to college or to think about, you know, the other options. So I had one of those detriments, but I didn't have, you know, one of those things was really helpful for me in the sense that I had that motivation. Long story medium, this isn't really a long story short, but some of the other schools that rose to the top there with my Google search, literally from my Google search, were the schools that had a particular, there was this national program called the Arabic Flagship Program, where the idea was to take people that had a base proficiency in Arabic and to turn it into a professional level proficiency. And I figured, well, that's a pretty good thing to study. One of those schools was University of Michigan. So I applied to all those schools, right? It's five schools at the time. And the first one I heard back from was University of Michigan, and they rejected me. And you know, okay, that stings, right? Like, I was rejected when I was 17. That made sense. I was an apathetic high schooler. I thought, now that I'm a Marine, right? Deployments, all these things, Arabic, right? Of course they'll, you know, no, they rejected me. And I, at the bottom of a rejection letter, right, is like the call this number if you have questions. And so I called and just politely asked, not trying to argue, like, how dare you not let me in, but really about like, hey, like, I still have some other live applications. I was really interested in Michigan. You know, if I were to reapply, what are the things I could do on my application? And I got connected to an admissions counselor there who was able to review my application and provided me with really clear guidance of, yeah, look, we need to see that you can be a good student, right? Like, you were an apathetic high schooler and we can tell, right? And you were a decent Arabic linguist, but I didn't knock it out of the park at DLI. So they needed for me to be able to show that I could actually get good grades. And so I said, okay, thank you. And I went, I was still an active duty Marine at the time. And I went the next day and just went to the local community college on base at Camp Lejeune and said, all right, what classes do you have? All right, we have an English class and a psychology class. Sign me up. And called back the admissions counselor at Michigan and said, okay, I'm signed up. I start next week. And then Michigan did a strange thing where they conditionally admitted me. So conditional on me getting A's in those two community college courses, which were only going to be 8 weeks long. They would admit me for that same cycle that I had been rejected at. And it's a really interesting example. And I think that that's a very specific set of circumstances. But part of the lesson that I pass on other people there is that it doesn't hurt to pick up the phone and to call and just ask for information. Most students aren't doing that. And sometimes there's something, there's a deficiency that you can correct. Like for me, I had to show that I could get A's. Right. And so I was able to do that for community. If ever there was a motivation to get A's in classes, that was it. So that was that's ultimately what led me to Michigan.
Awesome. So you got the A's and you headed to Michigan. And tell us like what the experience was like. How much of a gap did you have from getting your DD 214 to starting school?
Yeah, precious little. My separation date was August 14th and classes at Michigan. We were supposed to be there about mid-August as well. So with terminal leave, I had a few weeks to be able to go and, you know, grow a beard and, you know, do some things, travel around the country a little bit, but not much time. And I think that that's the experience for a lot of folks, right? You turn in your gear and then you're on a college campus. Doesn't give you a whole lot of time to process. And I came back from Iraq with some very strong opinions about our engagements abroad. And the notion of service, whether or not my service is a net value add and for humanity, right? Like some very tough stuff that I was working through. And I'm taking all of that into college. And for me, I didn't really want to have anything to do with the military. It's the great irony of my life now, right? That all day, every day, I talk to veterans and, you know, work with veterans. Because at the time, when I got out in 2010, I just didn't want to have anything to do with the military. And I set up that somewhat of a firewall there. And then that started to break down pretty quickly once I started. There were these really cool Outward Bound trips. Outward Bound used to sponsor veteran groups. And so Michigan had partnered to send a crew of people, like incoming students and prospective students, on this Outward Bound trip. And I thought, all right, I don't want to have anything to do with the veteran community, but I'll take a free trip out to Colorado, right? And go climb a 14er out there. And so I went there and I got to meet some veterans, right? So, okay, well, they invited me to a Student Veterans of America meeting. So, okay, well, you know, I'll go to this thing, right? I'll check this out. I'll see what this is like. And I was still very resistant to it, but it turns out that veterans are a group of people that I can affiliate with, right? That I can get along with in a way that it's a bit harder for me to figure out how to be a 22-year-old at the time, and to really be able to plug into the community in the traditional college classes. And so that was the group of people that I bonded with, right? Also with traditional students. I think it's important for veterans to try and be able to work outside of just the veteran community, to not be so insular, but that was a really important part of my education, was finding that balance and finding those, like, where those authentic connections are. And that also helped me sort out the veteran identity of it all, right? I'm not the only person that came back or comes out of military service with coming in hot with feelings about, you know, engagements abroad. I took a course called, you know, U.S. Wars in the Middle East. Like, yeah, I had some opinions about that course. But I think that that's part of the challenge, right? Is how do you articulate, how do you leverage your experience and bring that in a meaningful way into the college classroom which doesn't make you stand out, right, in a negative way, but allows you to be able to lift up the experiences of others and add perspectives while still being open to the perspectives of those that are around you. So I didn't have a perfect formula for it, but a lot of it came from just, you know, mentorship from veterans that were a bit further ahead in the process than I was.
Yeah, that's really really pretty cool. And then at Michigan, what was the veteran population like in terms of numbers? Like when you got on campus, were you immediately plugged into a group of vets there, or were you all pretty few and far between, and you just kind of got integrated into the normal campus?
Yeah. There's hundreds of veterans there then and now. I don't know the exact number now. There is, I'll say a disconnect in between the veterans club, the group of people that come together for the veterans club, and on the administrative side. And there's kind of a schism there right now, which is really unfortunate because I think it's to the detriment of all incoming and current student veterans. When I got there, the biggest source of connection that I had was with the veterans club. And then there was also some administrative connection there for the person that was running all the new student programs to include on the veteran side. And so that allowed me to be able to get some, support, like some formal support, while also getting the informal stuff from the vets club. And I think that's how it frankly should be. Like the best, putting on the WSP hat right now and thinking about what we see across all these various institutions, the most thorough support is when there is institutional buy-in, right? Like from the top, the institution that really understands at the top levels of leadership at the provost or the president level, that is able to pass down and say, hey, this is a priority for us as an institution, that then leads to robust actual administrative and faculty services that then is complemented by a group of student veterans that maybe have a faculty advisor, right? You need both sides of that in order for there to be this really robust engagement for recruitment, admissions, and then support while you are there. And so for a little bit, I think Michigan had something in that area, but it's not what it used to be.
Gotcha. And so what was your social group like at Michigan? Would you say it was a mix of veterans and just normal folks? Is it, you know, when you get to campus, you're older than the group, you've got you're kind of standard college student, you've had a lot of different experiences. I don't know if you you had a partner when you're on campus, or how things worked out for you there, but just what was the, you know, your basic kind of social breakdown when you got there?
Yeah, it was the people that I ended up bonding with and spending the most time with were fellow veterans. And then there were some groups that were associated with veterans. So for example, there was a group called Social Work for Veterans that was started by a military spouse there. And then she brought in some other people from the social work side that were just interested in supporting veterans, but weren't veterans themselves. And we did some cross-functional stuff, the student veterans chapter and then the Social Work for Veterans. And so that was a nice way to be able to bridge to people that were in different degree paths and also that were non-veterans. And again, I think that this is part of the lesson that I try and impart on people now, is that like really striving for those opportunities to look outside of the veteran bubble really matters. I had friends outside of that, but not many, right? Some people that I would take some classes with, or some people that were, I would do it, you know, back-to-back classes with, but the guys that I ended up living with, you know, were fellow veterans. And the only non-veteran that I lived with when I was there was because he was a friend of one of the veterans, which is fine. But it was primarily the veteran folks are the ones that I had the strongest connection with.
Gotcha. And what was the, was it mainly Marines, or was it across all branches?
Back then, what was the breakdown? I mean, I guess it's Marines, Navy were the two that there were some Army folks mixed in there, but I was staying out with them. I mean, you know, Marines stay close with each other, right? And I guess we consider you all in the Navy, you know, close enough that we'll spend time with you too. But
it's kind of funny because I mean, my experience going to school after I was in was, you know, when you're in the military, you put so much weight on not only your branch, but your MOS, you know, the Navy, your designated, like what your specific job is. But when you get out, it's hilarious just how much that all kind of falls by the wayside. And it's just like, yeah, we're all vets. And so when I was at school, like, it's actually funny. I think of all the branches, I had probably the fewest friends who were Navy vets. And I think my best friend was he was in the Air Force at school. The next one, you know, another great friend was a Marine. So it was kind of funny how everything the kind of self-imposed branch and, you know, service pride we put on falls by the wayside when we rejoin society?
I think it can, but I also think that in some ways it doesn't, right? Like, this is actually one of the challenges within the veteran community of the hierarchical nature of the military. You know, I've mentioned this a little bit before, but it's this notion of like, okay, well, you're in boot camp. Just wait until you like go through your combat training. And you go through that and you're like, all right, well, just wait until you're in the fleet. You're in the fleet. It's like, well, just wait until you deploy. And you deploy. And it's like, well, just wait until you deploy another time, or like with this particular unit, or just wait until you have combat experience, right? There's always some self-selection out, or there's always a way to look back at other people where you just got out of that zone, right? And you say like, oh, like, I can't believe, right? Like, you know, you're so green. And I also think that that's true, you know, between like pogues and grunts certainly within the military, right? Like, as somebody's a pogue, right? And has always had, you know, there's an aspect of what that looks like. Like, did I have the typical military experience? And when I say that, like, in some ways, the actual answer is actually yes, because the vast majority of veterans do not serve in combat. And yet the typical experience in the zeitgeist is that veterans have that type of combat experience. So it depends a little bit on what your definition is there. But I think that that can be an unfortunate byproduct when you get out of the military, is that sometimes people try and simulate that same sort of military hierarchical self-selecting exclusive culture in the veteran side. So for some things, I do think that generally veterans are, I don't know many veterans that will not associate with people from other branches, right? Which is good, right? So it's not as if it goes to the point of exclusion to that level. But I do think that there are many people, not I think, I've seen this time and time again, there are many people that will still try and hold themselves out on some sort of pedestal because of something that they, some sort of exclusive thing that they reached in the military. But on the veteran side, you know, who gives a shit, right? Like, it's something which just doesn't actually matter to the same level. Yes, your experiences matter and they shape you. But if you come into the veteran community and you're trying to still engage with that exact same level, right? And you're trying to, you know, pretend like you're all that. Well, you know, no, you have to be able to humble yourself to say, okay, now I'm in this. How do I leverage whatever going back to my class example, how do I leverage whatever experience I had in the military to be able to affect some sort of positive change? How do I leverage that experience so that it can help other people and lift people up, as opposed to just, you know, coming in with that, yeah, right, here's what I did, you know?
Yeah, you know, and so no, I do agree with you. Like, there was some of that. I saw when I was at school, there was the kind of classic like one-upsmanship. And the thing is, but it was always kind of like your usual suspects who did it. And in the community, it wasn't looked unfavorably. Like, we'd have, I remember one guy in our group chat was talking about, you know, quote unquote, stacking bodies in Iraq. And you're like, come on, man, shut up. You know, and, you know, like, you know, they would put, you know, there were things there that you would see where there, you know, people would try to do that one-upsmanship. And, It did not, I feel go over well, you know, in the general group. And it seemed like it was almost like the more people had actually done, the quieter they were. Like, we had one of our vets in our group was, he was an officer in SEAL Team 6, and he had all kinds of crazy experience, and he never felt the need to flex about his experience in the group. But it was kind of other people who did. And so it was kind of that, you know, for me, I always have, you know, deliberately not made a big deal about what I've done in the military, because I've never really thought what I've done is compared to a lot of the very impressive things a lot of my peers have done. So I guess when it's, you know, when it's all said and done, there is that one-upsmanship, but overall, it's not something that we as a community really benefit from. And I think the vast majority of us don't really like to hear it. So, that's just kind of my perspectives. Switching gears a little bit to your grad school journey. Sorry.
I'll just say, I agree with you. A lot of people don't like to hear it, but I think that a lot of people still participate in it. Right. And I speak, this is probably from the lens that I have within Warrior Scholar Project as well, where we have a mix of active duty and separated veterans and reservists and guardsmen. Right. And the number of times that we have to stop some sort of conversation around like, well, how many, you know, all right, you got one combat action ribbon. All right, well, you know, I got two, right? Or like, and it's just like, stop, right? Like, if people feed into that so easily and get into that exclusive club mentality, and that's a problem, right? So I think you're exactly right that most people shy away from it. And yet I think that because military culture puts so much priority and so much of the culture is in that area, that there are a lot of people that still gravitate towards it, right? Even if they don't like the fact that they're doing that, it's sort of like this natural, like, old hat aspect of it. And the other point is that, you know, your example of the stacking bodies, the concern there is that for every veteran who's just level-headed and is able to leverage their perspective, right? For every veteran that does that is talking about stacking bodies, it takes 100 people to counter that narrative for civilian classmates, right? The thing that they're going to remember is the buffoon that's talking about stuff like that, right? As opposed to the people that are just able to really meaningfully leverage their experience. And so this is where it, a relatively small contingent of people, I think, can really have a negative impact on the wider perception of veterans. Right. And this is partly, again, with the work of Warrior Scholar Project, where we're thinking first and foremost about the students that we're serving, but the impact is not just about the students that we're setting up for success in college for their own trajectory. It's about their ability to be able to influence the wider veteran culture at that school, but then also the wider civilian culture, right? And then beyond school, it has to be that positive ripple effect. And so that's the reason that, like, the upstream things for that, whenever I see people that are posturing like that, like, it just drives me nuts. And I call it out a lot more forcefully than I used to, or a lot more directly than I used to, because I've seen the way in which that can have this really like long-term negative effect.
And so to follow up on that, do you, from my experience, people would kind of call that out, like the flexing, from what you've seen, is it called out, or how do you, I guess, how do you really remedy it? And for me, I think, you know, positive peer pressure can be positive and it can be negative. And I think as a community, I think a lot of veterans on college campuses have focused on doing what you were talking about, is emphasizing the positives of our service and not trying to come in there, come into school like jarheads, and then actively discouraging their peers from making those kind of gung-ho military, you know, statements and, you know, flexing on their peers and things like that. So do you still see it as a problem? And if so, like, how do you think you can best remedy it?
Yeah, so there's a few different contexts, right? So one is within the WSP context, right? The Warrior Scholar Project Academic Bootcamp model. We can absolutely handle it because you're there for a reason, right? There is a tremendous amount of resources that are at your disposal right now, right? And we've had to raise a certain amount of money in order for you to be here, and every seat that you're filling is a seat that somebody else isn't. And so if you're going to keep up that behavior and you're not willing to grow, then tough darts, right? This isn't the right fit for you to be here. So we have a lot more specific ability to influence that because we're able to set the standard for what is and is not tolerated within our classrooms. I think that that's different than if I'm just out on the street and I meet somebody in that way. So for example, the neighbor that moved in last year, he's a cop, and he, you know, when he moved in, we were walking past with our kids, and it was very just sort of like Bush was like, yeah, like, if the kids want to get in the squad car, you know, just like anytime, right? Like, I've seen some stuff and I just got off this detail, right? And he's like talking with that tone. And I told, as we were walking away, I told my wife, like, one, I'm pretty, that's, it sounds very similar to, you know, some of the veterans we work with. So I'm like, I wish he would go to one of our boot camps, right? Because he's the sort of person that, like, all right, guy, like, I'm sure you have some really, really valuable experiences, but that is the most off-putting introduction possible. And I think that one of the things that we work through with our boot camps is so there's often this balancing of confidences. So some people come in and they're so confident in their abilities because of things they've done in the military. And one of the things I'll say, like, from the enlisted side in particular, I think you get really good at a particular thing, right? You can become a subject matter expert in a particular thing. And that can build a lot of confidence, and that's good. But then you go into this new world where you might feel like you missed the boat in a traditional academic experience. Well, you did miss the boat in a traditional academic experience, so now you're non-traditional. And sometimes people will use that to overcompensate, right? And they'll feel like, okay, well, I really need to tap into these things. And so I think having direct conversation with people around, like, hey, one, that's just not an approachable way to enter into a conversation. And two, like, what are the actual reasons for that? Like, what are the concerns that you have around going into higher education or whatever the thing is? People being open to that, I think, is valuable. And I also think, I mean, another version of this that you can think about is just if you're trying to have people, right, at our boot camps for the humanities one, democracy focused, they're reading the Constitution, they're reading the Declaration of Independence, they're reading the Federalist Papers, some of the Federalist Papers, having veterans who have all served read those documents from, and they're all from, you know, every shade of the political spectrum, debating the merits of democracy, creates these really good conversations. And if you are going into any of those conversations with just, my mind is made up, this is what I believe, I'm not listening to anybody, then again, like, why are you here at the boot camp? And also, don't just go, you're not going to get the whole college experience, right? You're going to miss so much more if you are going in with this closed mind around like exactly who you are, exactly what you believe. And so it's part of this broader expansion where I think that some of the ways that people react and that posturing is a symptom of either some sort of insecurity and or, you know, just some like inability. They don't have the experience with engaging in conversations where they can not come in with that sort of bravado, right? I even mentioned that, like why to join the Marine Corps? Like, well, all right, the Marines got some swagger, right? Like he's, you know, full of bluster when I was 17 and that appeals to me. And that's part of the culture. So I think it's that broader sort of holistic approach that can help, but it's hard to do that. And there's no like, I don't know, essay I could write that would get into the hands of all the people that are acting in that way that would, you know, change their behavior. This is much more sort of intensive one-on-one or small group dynamics that I think it takes to really be able to change that for any individual.
Yeah. And so I think this is a good segue. I was going to actually, before we get into WSP, would you mind just giving just a quick background on your journey from Michigan to law school to WSP? And then we can get into kind of the mission of WSP and the good work y'all are doing.
Sure. I knew that I was really interested in continuing service in some way. I didn't know exactly what that would mean, what that could look like. I was fairly sure by the end of undergrad that I wanted to go to graduate school of some sort, and I was fairly sure that that was going to be law school. So I proactively took the GRE and the LSAT to keep my options open. And I learned about Teach for America, I taught ninth grade English for a couple of years in Detroit with Teach for America immediately upon graduation. And plug for that, right? I think we need a lot more veterans in the classroom. It's the most challenging job that I've ever had by some margin. And I wouldn't take it back for anything. It was very formative for me in terms of, one, specifically to the work that I do now with understanding curriculum design and assessment and pedagogy and scaffolding and all of these things, but also just the perspective that you gain from being a teacher. It is infinitely more difficult than what people think it actually entails. The hours are nuts. We were very under-resourced. And I think that this is the sort of area where veterans can really rise to the occasion, right? You've had to work with a group of people before, and you've had to be able to accomplish a mission no matter what the resources are, generally speaking. So I'm a big advocate for veterans, whether it's to Teach for America or otherwise, pursuing even a part-time or even a short-term career or short-term employment in education. We could have a long conversation around what I see as the, you know, huge inequities within our education system. But I'm a big advocate for that. I also think that it appeals in terms of a continuing service, right? So I liked the idea of serving in the military. That was one of the things that drew me to it. And this was another way to be able to do service in a different form. I thought maybe I was just going to be a high school teacher in perpetuity if I liked it, right? If it clicked, then I was going to be happy to continue to do that. But it's not the best utilization of my skill set, right? That job, as I said, not only was it difficult, but also I felt like I wasn't really making an impact that some of my colleagues were, right? Some of the people around me that were particularly well-equipped for teaching. My wife is a teacher, and she's the sort of person that like is meant to be a teacher and is excellent at what she does. So I didn't feel like I was in that zone in high school. So I decided to apply to law school. I ended up going to UVA, which I am just an unabashed or unavowed, I don't know, whatever the word is I'm looking for here. I'm a huge advocate for people to go to UVA when they're considering law school. I think that the culture there really fit what I was looking for. It's a group of people that like it's a great law school, but they were also people that were willing to be able to be humans. It didn't feel incredibly competitive. Charlottesville is a wonderful place. I had a much more successful grad school application cycle than I did for undergrad. So I think I was able to learn a lot along the way and apply a lot of those lessons to that process. And I really enjoyed my time at UVA. Did a number of clinics, some stuff on the veterans pro bono side, some have a legal aid. And then I ended up working after law school at a national law firm for about a year before I came on board to Warrior Scholar Project full time. So been doing WSP now for about a decade, which is hard to believe. 5 years of that was part time. And then in 2018, I left the law firm to come on board to Warrior Scholar Project full time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm with you there. It was crazy because I started at Service to School as a volunteer in 2015. So coming up on that 10 year mark. So it's pretty crazy. And so tell me about your journey to WSP and becoming its CEO, and what drew you to the organization? What about its mission really resonated with you, and how you've sought to use the organization to help prepare veterans to transition from the military service to higher education?
Yeah. So for me, it was very natural. The way that I learned about the WSP impact, it was very hands-on. It wasn't really something about reading about it in a pamphlet, which I don't think would have had as much impact on me. One of my friends who I deployed with and went to language school with was one of the very few veterans at Yale at the time. This was back in 2013. So he knew I'd got involved with student veteran advocacy when I was an undergrad, and he called me and he said, hey, there's this thing called Warrior Scholar Project. They ran a pilot last year, 2012. They're doing it again here. You're into student veteran stuff. You should come see this, right? This is like nothing else that's out there. Trust my friend. So I went out there. And for some scheduling reasons, because I was still a teacher at the time, I only had one day, right? Like literally one day to go out there. So I fly out to New Haven. And I arrive and I go into a class that was taught by the professor who passed away a couple of years ago, the late Charles Hill, this incredible, iconic Yale professor. And he's going through, Tocqueville quality of conditions argument or the Federalist Papers, right? One of these readings. And he's going through this with this deeply engaged group of student veterans, right? Like people that were in student veteran. I use that word even loosely here because for a lot of them, they weren't even in school yet, right? They're active duty veterans and they come here to Yale for a period of time. And there's this discussion, right? It's really back and forth. The students have actually like clearly done the readings. The professor is really amped up about it. So it's just like, what world did I step into, right? Like, what are they able to facilitate here? And like, how is this happening? Afterwards, on his way out, I pulled the professor aside and I asked, like, is this just like what Yale classes are like? No, this is not what all Yale classes are like, right? There's something special about the level of engagement that is happening here. I talked to a bunch of the students. I talked to the founders. And then I got on a plane that night. And they were looking to expand from the pilot at Yale, and they gave a small group of us basically the license to be able to launch a branch of Warrior Scholar Project at Michigan in the summer of 2014. So my engagement for that year was working with the founders and all of these things to figure out what we need to do to make the program happen. And we ran it in 2014, figured a lot of stuff out while we were doing it for the first time. There wasn't like a clear expansion model at the time, and a lot of the curriculums in flux and all these things. But it was the most life-giving and rewarding experience that I had had to my life, that I had of my life so far to that point. We did it for 1 week. It was a humanities boot camp. I was just exhausted, like bone tired at the end of it, but it was the best. And so we did that again in 2015, right? Very similar crew, found writing instructors, found faculty, found, you know, all these different folks from the institution. And similar thing, incredibly tired, but had to go back. And so for every summer while I was in law school, that's what I would do. And then when I was in corporate litigation, kind of where the organization was and where I was, okay, well, I can't really continue to do that at this level. It wasn't volunteer work, but it also, right, like at this point, I really need to be able to build my career. And then in 2018, I had a conversation with one of the founders for old time's sake. He's another attorney in Chicago. We met up and I just sort of said, you know, I always think if there was a way I could do Warrior Scholar Project full time. And his answer was, well, you know, what if there was? So the organization was on the cusp of getting this capacity building grant that would actually allow it to hire a chief operating officer, which was the role that I initially filled, and grow out a staff as opposed to just, you know, really, really lean and mean. I think we're still lean and mean, but like it was very lean at that time. And so I was in the COO capacity for a year. I left the law firm and came on board. And then stepped into the CEO role in 2019. And now it's been 4 years. See, now I'm of the mindset that everybody should know all the answers to all of those questions already. How dare somebody not know WSP and, you know, all of our bootcamp schedule? No, I appreciate the question, and it's an easy thing to gloss over. So in essence, Warrior Scholar Project is serving enlisted veterans, and we are helping them figure out how to kick ass in college. And we're helping them figure out how to be able to build that plan for what comes next. And then how to really engage in civic society and how to be able to leverage military experience and education into that huge impact. I mentioned that ripple effect that can happen early on, right? And that's really what we believe, that if we can make this impact on these people now, they go back to their communities and they go to their communities, and you can have this really seismic impact. There's a few different types of programs that we offer. The core, the one that's the most well-known and the one that we spend basically our entire summer on is a series of academic boot camps. So those are offered in three disciplines: humanities, STEM, and business and entrepreneurship. We had 21 college university partners this year. It'll grow a little bit by next year. And these are week-long increments. So each one of those, humanities, STEM, and or business, are week-long increments. And we are putting people that are not already matriculating at that school typically. So when I mentioned, for example, if I talk about the Yale boot camp, I'm not talking about student veterans who are already admitted at Yale. There's some that go through that are already there, but most of them are not. We're taking people that are active duty, that are veterans, reservists, guard, whatever, putting them on Yale for a week or two, depending on the course that they're going through. And they're living in the residence halls, they're eating in the dining facilities, they're taking classes in the classrooms, and they get a really rigorous education that is first grounded in that content area, humanities, STEM, or business. But then is also about the social, psychological aspects of transition. So yes, you're reading Thucydides, you're reading Herodotus, you know, you're reading Tocqueville, you're reading all of these authors, and you're discussing it with faculty members from that institution. And you're also getting very tailored, specific writing instruction. But in the evenings, you're really working with alumni of our program that can talk about, hey, what's it really like to be a successful student veteran that's on campus? It's not just that academic component. It's about, you know, what is it like to be an older student? What is it like to be a non-traditional student on campus? So we want to be able to serve the holistic picture of what it looks like for somebody to be successful. For the services that we don't provide, we still talk about things in terms of resources for other people to reach out to. So for example, mental health comes up time and time and time again. We have to be clear with our participants that we're not a mental health organization, but because of the intensive nature of our programs, those issues do come up, right? Like, it can really push on these things, and for any number of reasons. It's about like 70 to 80 hours of work per week for a boot camp. It's exhausting, right? And that's part of the point, like that's part of the reason this works. So when those sorts of other things come up, whether it's mental health or physical health, we want to be able to support students, but we also talk to them about like what that's like when you are on campus as a student, right? And what resources you can avail yourself of to be able to take care of yourself, right? If you have a disability, I myself am a disabled veteran, right? I can't type like a normal person. So like, I need to use accommodation services to be able to actually, to be able to succeed in school. So we talk about some of those nitty gritty things as well. But through the lens of the real academic side, a huge part of it is about confidence building. What we tell our students is that if you can make it through this week, then you can absolutely make it through a full course at any one of these institutions, right? You could make it through a program at these institutions. There's a huge problem with veterans self-selecting out of rigorous top-tier education. And it's not top-tier or bust. It's about finding the right fit. But there are way too many people that are self-selecting out because they just don't think they have what it takes to succeed at that level. And they do, with the right support. So it's confidence is a huge piece for what we do. The other things that we do, we have a series of workshops that we run at community colleges that are one-day workshops. And then we also have graduate school support for alumni that go through our program, building out things in the career pathway side. So there's a lot of other services that we offer, but the core one that we're most well known for is really the academic boot camps.
Yeah, and so there are so many kind of cross alumni, both Service School and Warrior Scholar Program, and we really offer, I feel, very complimentary services, because Service School's job is to get veterans into college, and Warrior Scholar Project's job is basically to prepare them to succeed when they get there. So I feel that if you're a Service School applicant, you should definitely be checking out Warrior Scholar Project. And Ryan, to confirm one thing for our listeners, do they have to pay anything to attend a Warrior Scholar Project bootcamp?
Nada. They just have to get themselves there. Yeah, but the rest of it, that's my job and the board and development team and all that, to fundraise enough so that you don't have to pay a cent for the program.
Absolutely. And then how far in advance do they need to look to sign up for a program? Do they fill up like a year in advance, 6 months in advance, or like what kind of timeline are people on?
Yeah, so there's an application for this. And so that is an important point, that it's not just something where it's just like signing up and then everybody is automatically placed on there. Now, we want to have a spot for anybody who is the right fit for the program. But if you're somebody that isn't in a stage that you are really willing to take this on, right, or you're not really sure about, whether or not you want to, it's okay if you're not sure if you want to go to school. But we ask some questions, some pretty probing questions in our application to really understand, like, hey, is this resource going to be the right fit for where you are in your journey? If the answer is yes, then let's find you a spot. Application cycle operates at a couple different places. So right now the application is open, but only for, we run two virtual boot camps in December. So if people are interested, depending on when this is published, you can go to our website, warrior-scholar.org. There's an apply button on there. And that will give you access to the initial interest form. Once you fill out the interest form, you'll be connected to a member of our team from our outreach team, who will learn more about you, tell you more about our programs. And if it seems like it's a good fit, then we'll send you a private link to the full application. The application for summer 2024 programs, where we will be, again, slight growth, but still roughly 21, 22 institutions for next summer, that will be open either at the end of this year, but certainly by January. That's typically when we open it. We've tried out a few different windows for it, but earlier that you apply, I think the better, at making sure that this is, you can fit it in with your schedule. And that you can work with our outreach team to make sure all of your questions are answered. I also haven't really listed institutions, but to give people some sense, right, we're working with private institutions and public institutions. So we're working, I mentioned, you know, Yale, but we're also at Princeton. We're at Cornell. We're at institutions like state institutions like University of North Carolina. We're going to be launching at some other state institutions. I mentioned University of Illinois, right? So we're at U of I, even though they rejected me when I was 17, you know, I can't hold that against them. So, you know, we decided to still do a program with them, and they've been phenomenal partners. We want to expand more in the Southeast and the Pacific Northwest. We have some news in that area that we'll be announcing for 2024 soon. So we want to be able to have coverage throughout the country. We want people to be able to have an opportunity to explore what institutions are like at the private or public level, depending on what they're looking for. But yeah, the earlier the better. And at any event, if somebody's interested, you can go click in that interest form is a really quick thing that you can fill out on the website. And at a minimum, that will connect you with a member of our team that you can talk to, they can speak to, and more specificity about what might be a good fit for what you're looking for.
Gotcha. And where in the journey do you think that to higher education, do you think that the boot camp fits best? And I'm guessing the answer is it depends, but is it something you should be doing like right before you want to go to college, or should it be like right after you get out and you're thinking things through, or how would you play it?
So if I had my druthers, everybody would go through this program 6 to 12 months before they separate from the military. The opportunity for somebody to be able to leverage their military experience and to not waste time with trying to figure out what comes next. If you can get this information, we talk about creating informed consumers of higher education, right? It's building the confidence, but it's also, where can I go? What does it look like to go to this school? How do I build my path? How does that connect to a career outcome? The earlier that you can get that, the better. TAP should be doing this. I think TAP has made some improvements, not enough, in my humble opinion. In particular in the area of education. And so I think somebody going through there, that's the optimal time. About 40 to 50% of our population every summer comes from active duty. So we also work with commands, whether that's for helping people apply for TDY or PTAT or leave or whatever letters people need. We're well equipped to be able to help support people in that way. That's my honest answer, is like, that is the optimal time to go before you have spent down your GI Bill, before you've earned your bachelor's degree, because oftentimes people will come to us and say, hey, I have my bachelor's, it's not doing anything for me, how can you help? It's harder. It's harder to help people once you have that bachelor's, right? Because there are very few institutions that will accept you for a second bachelor's to change course or to do a reset or anything like that. So I would prefer to, we would really prefer to work with people that are upstream. Having said that, we also work with a number of people that got out even decades ago, right? That want to go back and complete their education and they use this as a catalyst. Fine. We would love to serve you, right? So the optimal time, I think, is before you get out. But even if you have missed that window, that shouldn't be a barrier. The eligibility criteria, the hard and fast ones for us, is enlisted and does not yet have a bachelor's degree. There's a few exceptions for the bachelor side, but it has to be a pretty dated version of when you received your bachelor's. If you just got your bachelor's right now, we're not in a position to be able to serve folks through those boot camps.
Gotcha. And then question about, what about doing multiple boot camps? Like both STEM, humanities, and entrepreneurship sound like really cool things. Can veterans do several, or do they have to kind of pick their take their pick in and live with it?
Yeah. So for a lot of the programs, we set them up so that they go week into week. So for example, the what's the institution I haven't talked about yet? That's a 2-week University of Arizona, right? Is a humanities into STEM program. So you have a humanities week, and then you get a few hours off on Saturday, and then you're back at it for STEM. So for people that are interested in both of those, and we encourage people that are interested in STEM to not forget about the humanities, because that is also a very important skill set. We work with people to identify what they're interested in and then try and place them in those boot camps that are the best fit. Also, some people will go through all three. We have a few, you know, triple headers that will also sign up, and there happens to be a spot. They apply for a business boot camp. Sometimes that happens over the course of multiple summers, where somebody will do humanities and STEM 1 year and then reapply to come back on the business side. So it really just depends on the year, on spots that are available. But that's where that interest form is really helpful. Hey, here's what I'm interested in. Here's what I'm looking for. Is there a good fit? You'll get a call from our outreach team very shortly after that application to talk through it.
Gotcha. And I know the interview is running a little bit long, but I just do have one more question, and then I'll turn it over to you for some closing thoughts. But would you mind, you've touched a little bit on the curriculum of the boot camps, but would you mind giving our listeners like a little bit of an idea of what to expect, a typical day to look like in each of the three?
Yeah. So the course structure for them isn't that different. The content and some of like what, you know, specifically what you'll be doing will change. But the basic structure is that you are starting with, you're starting in the morning with a study group. So you're going over the materials that you were supposed to read from the previous night, right? Sometimes people are doing that early in the morning. You're getting the wheels turning. That's not with a faculty member from the institution, but you're doing that internally with your student, with your fellow students, and with one of our alumni fellows to guide the discussion. You go into a morning lecture on the humanities side. Again, that's on usually, it's typically sort of described as the foundations of democracy. On the STEM side, it's focused on physics. That's a nice lens to be able to apply a bunch of other things along the way. On the business entrepreneurship side, that can be in accounting, that can be in finance, that can be on marketing, right? Content specific things there. But you're going into a lecture, and that's taught by, or a, hopefully it's not pure lecture, right? We describe it as a lecture, but hopefully it's more of a, we work with the faculty to hopefully make it more of a seminar, an engaging seminar. But those are faculty from the institutions. Then you go to lunch. In the humanities side, in the afternoon, it's all writing. So you're working with writing instructors from the institution that are helping you put together some college level writing. On the STEM side, you'll do a couple things. There's some primers that are just on math, on core math skills. And then there's also some things that are on research projects where you're actually applying the things that you're learning and you're putting it into real world practice using Python and using some other skills along the way to be able to do some pretty cool stuff. And on the business side, instead of writing or the research projects, the thing on the business side is these entrepreneurship projects. So applying these principles to working with a group of your peers to put together a pitch deck, right? And an idea that you pitch on Friday. That's the academic day for each one of those, humanities, STEM, and business. And then in the evening is when you're working on what we refer to as the college success track. So it's a mix of study time and working on things, writing, reading, whatever. But then also the sessions that are on, what does it look like to be an informed consumer of higher education? How do you study? What are the effective ways to be able to manage your time and avoid procrastination? These are the sorts of things that we hit in the evening that are about the academic side, but they're also about the broader, again, social psychological aspects of transition. And then Friday, we wrap it all up. Writing papers are turned in, entrepreneurship pitch sessions happen, research project presentations happen. We do an end of course reception, shake some hands, and then we break.
Yeah, really, really cool stuff. All right, Ryan, I know you're a busy man, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I'd just like to turn it over to you just for any closing thoughts, words of wisdom you may have for our listeners, or anything I might have missed about Warrior Scholar Project.
Words of wisdom. Oh, man. That's let's see if I can drum up anything there. One of the big things that I come back to time and time again with this community is really encouraging people not to settle for the easy thing. My example of that is with the online for-profit institution, that was sort of the known path that some of my peers were going, and something that to me just like, well, no, I'm going to do something a little bit different. And I'm really thankful that I picked that course, that I went that path. I think we see that all the time in this community of people that feel like somewhat of a fish out of water when it comes to education. And there's a lot of settling that happens, or there's a lot of, well, I don't really have what it takes. You do. You have to seek out the right support structure, but with the right support structure, you absolutely can succeed on the educational path if that is the right fit for you. That's actually one important point as well that I'll say, which partly wraps up for WSP, and maybe there's some wisdom to it as well. When we talk about being an informed consumer, if somebody goes through a Warrior Scholar Project bootcamp and they say, you know what, I have what it takes, I could do this, but college is not the right step for me now or ever, that still is a success in our book. If that is an informed decision, that it's not self-selecting out because you don't think you have what it takes, but because, you know what, this doesn't actually align with my career ambitions, that's totally fine. And I think that sometimes we get so caught up in like, well, it has to be an Ivy League institution, right? Ivy League education. No, it really doesn't. And so that broader picture, I think, matters for people to be able to really understand what it looks like to make those informed decisions. But if you want to do it, don't just settle for the easy path. I agree with you with what you said, Alec. I think there's a really strong, connection between service to school and WSP. We actively encourage WSP alumni to sign up for service to school if they haven't already done so. And so hope we can get a lot more folks from service to school coming our way.
Absolutely. Ryan, thank you so much for your time and for all you do.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Right back at you.
That's all we have for this episode. Join us next week, same time, same place, where we share more service to school stories. Service to School Stories is hosted by Sydney Mathis, Chief Program Officer, and Alec Emmert, Service to School CEO. Our podcast is produced and edited by our Director of Communication, Amanda Tobias. Service to School is a 501c3 nonprofit providing free college admission support to transitioning service members and veterans. Join us next week and follow us for more on your favorite social media platforms.